that their Wi-Fi is down and they can't listen to the latest episode of Stick to Wrestling. Hello, everyone. I'm John McAdam. Give us 60 minutes and we will give you a wicked good wrestling podcast. And let me bring on my convivial co-host, who is very lamenting the fact that I will never run out of songs, Sean Goodwin. Sean, how are you?
I've conceded on the song issue just because the popular man is getting out of control. We actually, since we're going to talk about the Facebook, we had a Facebook thread about it. Before I start that, though, to our Jewish friends out there, I'd like to wish a Shana Tova, a Happy New Year. This is being recorded on the final day of Yom Kippur. So to our friends out there and to our Facebook group now. It's just awesome. I don't know how else to say it. I mean, right now there is a 1986 match between Ric Flair and Nick Bockwinkel from Winnipeg. I mean, that's awesome. A picture of Nick taking the belt from Otto Wanz. We have pictures of Jamie Ward with women. So we're excited about that. And a couple of tributes to Whitey Caldwell, who died tragically in a car accident October 8th, 1972, a Tennessee legend. We also have John's random event clippings, my random wrestling videos like Fritz Von Erich versus Reggie Park from 1960. It's old school wrestling Disneyland, except free and no lines.
All right, and I will put something else on the Facebook group. This podcast is going to come out October the 10th, and is the great Antonio's birthday. And this is a real wrestler. He's not Homeless Tom or anything. The great Antonio is known for pretty much one thing and one thing only. He had a match against Antonio Inoki. I'm going to guess this is 1975, and it looked like he pissed Inoki off by acting like a clown to start with, and then Inoki stiffed him. And Inoki, and pardon my French, but there's no other real word to say it, beat the shit out of this guy. He kicked him in the face three times, stomped on his head, left him in a bloody pulp. We'll put this on for you on our Facebook group. So happy birthday to the late, great Antonio.
How's your face?
Thank you for doing something memorable in your life. And with that, last thing I want to bring up is, follow me on Twitter. It's John McAdam. Just put that in the search. Go with the picture of the guy hitting the other guy in the head with a chair. I don't stick to wrestling on Twitter. I answer questions like, what are the albums in which the best song on it is not sung by the usual lead singer? You want to know that about me? Follow me on Twitter. I am excited to have on as a guest a good friend of mine, a very knowledgeable wrestling fan, cool guy, Keith Valentine. Keith, thank you for joining us.
No problem, man. Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Now, before we get to our mailbag, and this is the October of Inquiry, we're going to be answering your questions from the Facebook group. If you're not part of the Facebook group, join and feel free to ask this podcast a question. Pro wrestling had a really big week last week. Sean, let me ask you this. Did you watch any of it?
No.
Okay, that's – you know what? I get it, because I have had people say to me, look, this is not the wrestling I grew up on. Have fun watching it. But
and that's it. You know, I'm not criticizing either. God bless. Yeah. It's a different thing.
Yeah, and that's totally cool. I get that. But I want to get both of your general opinions on something. Let me give everyone the background on this. Okay? Last Sunday, the WWF had a pay-per-view, which is a misnomer, but anyway, it featured The Fiend, who I like, I don't care what anyone thinks, against Seth Rollins in a Hell in a Cell match. Long story short, the referee declares a no contest in this match, people were unhappy Sunday night on the internet before I went to bed. And by the time I got up the next morning, Twitter and Facebook were a goddamn fire tire over this, because and I get it. You want to have Hell in a Cell, the ultimate match to settle a feud, as opposed to being the first match. But the main complaint is the main complaint is OMG, they had a non-pinfall/submission finish in a Hell in a Cell match. And I want to get your thoughts on that. Keith, what's your opinion on that? Do you agree with that? Disagree with it?
I didn't particularly care for the way that it ended, just because it's like you're either going to go with something, like it's either pull the trigger on something or don't pull the trigger on something. But WWE has had a history of that, to where they kind of tease what people are interested in. And then when it gets down to it, people in charge make a different decision, and which is their right because it's their company. So you kind of have as a WD fan, you kind of be like, well, like, you know, it's kind of like, I know what I'm dealing with. Like, it's not a disappointment, and it's just kind of like, you could have really took it to a whole other thing. But at the same time, what I want as a fan doesn't necessarily equate to maybe what's best for business, because I have a weird, different kind of perspective on it. I look at it as like, I look at, if it grows organically, then that's the product you need to push. But at the same time, I'm not the one financing it, so I can't fight that. Like, I can't argue with that. Like, I see that point of it too. It's just, do I feel like they dropped the ball in that regards? Absolutely. They kind of dropped the ball the past 2 weeks, to be honest. Like, this whole week, like, they did a couple of things great, and then they did a couple of things not so great. And it's just kind of like a two steps forward, two steps back kind of situation.
No, I hear what you're saying, and I'm sort of a hypocrite. Like, I'm like, hey, you know, it's the wrestling. It's wrestling. I don't get to write the script. I'm not the booker. But God forbid the Red Sox do something I don't like, and I act like I own the team, or, you know, that, so that's just how I am. I think a fan's allowed to be critical. I don't think they should be taking ownership on that. Sean, speaking generally, how do you feel about, like, the non-finish versus finish debate?
Oh, I definitely have an opinion about this. Okay. The Pats are playing the Giants tomorrow, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Say you drop $200, whatever it is, go over there, say $800, bring a FOIA, bring the family, all that stuff. Midway through the third quarter, they stop, they declare it a draw. How do you think that's going to go over?
It's not. You're correct.
I'm looking at the rules of a Hell in a Cell match. I have had this tirade before, but I will do it again. Since I guess they're still doing this, the rules are, let's see, it is based, my understanding is submission or pinfall.
That's correct? My understanding as well.
Yeah, correct.
So then we have a stoppage of the thing. Okay, this is just like the time that Ole had, and this, I'll blame old guys for this too, when Ole had Dusty get jumped in the cage. Okay, you're like, well, it only happened one time. Well, great. Now it's happened a million times since then. I've gone on this tirade about Texas death matches. If it's advertised as something, you should give the fans – and this is where you're wrong, John, because it's not about ownership. These people paid tickets and paid money to go see this event, and they go to see something that's advertised, and they did not deliver.
I agree with that. But at the same time, it's wrestling. Is it that important to you that you see this particular finish as opposed to a different finish?
When they advertise it, yes.
I get that.
If my sense is, after what they pulled with the whole Kofi Brock situation, is I think it's kind of like it would have put some more interest on Monday Night Raw, and especially would have changed up. If you're trying to build up this draft, that kind of shift makes it unpredictable, which makes you now have to really, like, the AEW / whatever this little war, you know what I mean, this competition is, it amps it up. And that's the thing. WWE kind of played it safe and then did their, like, what you said. Like, they did what they did what they've done a million times, and fans are tired of it. And you do feel like you kind of get, like, cheated a little bit, because it's like, you know what I mean? You could have ended this in a way and then would have been like, you could have amplified it. You could have continued on in a way that we don't know what's going to happen. Because as a fan, I love being surprised.
I mean, yeah, same here. Like being, go ahead. I'm sorry.
But I don't like, you know what I mean? Like, there's a way you can shock somebody. There's a way you can surprise somebody. But then there's also, you can pull the trigger on something. Because since the Fiend came back, there's nothing like that in professional wrestling. Nothing like it. And you just had him put down a lot of different people, including Braun Strowman. That should have been the indication that he was going to be strong enough to sit there and come out with the title. And then it would have turned into, what would Monday night be like? What would Monday of night been like? You know, how would the Firefly thing would have been like? How crazy would it have all been? And then there's a way that you can sit there and you can start to build from there. But they didn't do that. They just went with it. They went with the cheap finish, like you said. And I do agree with you on that.
You know, here's my perspective on it, from a couple of different angles. Let's say they had Seth just pin him 1, 2, 3, and then all that stuff happens with the Fiend. Is that really the gulf of difference between, okay, now I'm happy and I'm on Twitter showing you that I canceled WWE Network? And I look at it from a different perspective too. Like, every day I I skipped today because one of the websites is down. I try to put up like results from 40 years ago, and sometimes it'll be a WWF card, and someone will say, "Wow, 3 non-finishes in 7 matches." And as a kid growing up watching the old WWF, you know, we'd go to the Boston Garden, and they'd be like maybe 9 matches, and 4 of them would end in weird finishes, and we thought nothing of it because, you know, that's how it goes. If you do this to this guy, you get disqualified. Those are the rules. I don't know. I guess it's what I grew up
on. No. This is not what you grew up on. This is like having, let's say, in Shea Stadium, Zbyszko and San Martino in the cage, and they stop it 10 minutes in. How would that have gone over? You think the fans would have said, "Yeah, well, it was a good match," and you know, they were promised a winner, and they did not get a winner.
Okay, you know what said, though? If they had done exactly what they did in Hell in the Cell, which is kind of stupid, Seth Rollins hits the Fiend with a sledgehammer, and oh my God, this match needs to be stopped. I think if Bruno had brutalized Zbyszko to that point, Shea would have been fine with it.
Let me ask you this then. What is the point if you're going to try something this risky, something this kind of outside of the regular norm of how things work? There should be a good reason for it. For example, like in 1980 when they had the cage match with Dusty, the Assassins, and that whole mess, that led to a massive angle. So I still don't like it, but there was a point. Why did there need to be no finish here? Was there a reason?
There was. Like I said, that basically Seth pretty much killed the guy. We need to get this guy into a stretcher, into an ambulance, to the hospital right away. We don't have time for a pinfall. At least you could rationalize it that way.
Well,
yeah, go ahead, Keith.
Wouldn't it have been better that if, like, say if he did Seth Rollins, or say if he, like, hit him with a low blow or did something to where the ref, or Bray Wyatt did something to Seth Rollins, to then have Seth Rollins come back and attack him? Like, you made it to where Bray Wyatt took it too far, because the thing about Bray Wyatt, and you've been able to do this pretty much since he wrestled Cena, there's always that element of like that Dark Knight match of how far are you willing to go with this man, because he represents a certain kind of embodiment that is like, you don't know how deep the water is with Bray Wyatt, but you know, like, you might have to go to a dark, dark place to beat him. So to constantly have that angle, I think, is always a great thing to do, because then you get to sit there and experiment with that angle with different people. But the way that it flowed, like, it didn't flow. Like, it started going, he started eating these shots, and then it was like he did the thing with the sledgehammer, and it was just kind of like, you made it seem like Seth went too far, but it's Hell in a Cell, so he should be able to go too far.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. It feels like they're changing the rules, and we're just supposed to sit there and be like, well, what do we do with this? So it does leave a lot in your lap, like, because it wasn't an understandable finish.
Yeah, for like, John, for Halloween, you should bring out the ghost of Stanley Blackburn.
You see, right now, I'm not being critical here. You haven't watched it, so you haven't seen the Fiend develop. It's actually really cool. Keith, let me ask you this. AEW, they made their debut. We actually record right before AEW starts. So last week, they made their debut. What did you think of the show?
I thought it was paced out really, really good. I thought the opening match with Sammy Guevara and Cody Rhodes was a really solid match. You could tell it was kind of like jitters, but like the feel of the show feels like a real show. Like, it really kind of feels like WWE in the form is like how the arena looks, but they have their own little touches, like the holographic banners along the side. It all look really, really good. There's not a lot of backstage segments.
Yeah.
Like, they do a lot of interviewing right there out in front of the people, which I like, which means that if they're not doing that, they're doing scripted promos. Or promos in the back where guys are cutting them, and it's kind of isolated, which is really good because they know how to break that fourth wall. And they really kind of just like opened it up to everybody. But the women's match for the title was really good. I thought the spot with Kenny Omega coming out for the girl Riho, if you've ever seen the 9-year-old girl Kenny Omega wrestled, she grew up to be a professional wrestler. And she won AEW's women's title against Nyla Rose, who I think honestly is a future champion. She's really strong. She is transgender, and that is going to be something that they approach. But I think also they're approaching it from a personal standpoint. And AEW is very welcoming to any type of people, whoever. It's about wrestling, and that's what I kind of like about it. There are some spots like there's some people who don't like the guy Orange Cassidy, with a little kind of lackadaisical gimmick that he has.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really fun. Like, when it gets going, like, it's really fun. And it just kind of makes you laugh a little bit, which is kind of like what I miss about wrestling. Like, even in the serious moments, having those moments where you can laugh at it. The spots and things that people came in, like, at them signing Santana and Ortiz from TNA. They're a solid tag team. They're in the future of it. I don't know if you guys know this. Jon Moxley made his return from his staph infection and took out Kenny Omega.
I did see that. Really hot spot.
Like, Jon Moxley, when he comes in the building, it's that stone cold feeling of like the old shit when the glass breaks. It really has that, like, he really brings that energy.
I was going to say, Keith, after you, you're our guest, man.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to keep talking all the way up. And then, but even with the Moxley angle, I was talking to my cousin about this. I love the fact of they are basically stripping Kenny Omega down, because when Kenny Omega does become champion, which will happen in AEW, it's going to be red hot. But they're kind of like humbling him right now in a sense. But his win-loss record, he lost to Jericho, he lost to Pac. And then, even getting taken out a couple of times already, it's like, people review you as the best in the world, but right now, you're in a different league too. And it kind of makes it, and I think they're going to do the same thing with the Bucks, which I think is a brilliant, brilliant move, because then you don't have them being the top guys just automatically coming out on top.
No, that makes a lot of sense. You know, a couple of things about the show. I really liked it. It had a huge crowd. It looked like about 14,000 people. And it was different than WWE, when some people come in, like, you know, especially every time they go to Chicago, like they're spending their money on WWE, but they're like mad at WWE. Everyone was happy to be there. The crowd was crazy enthusiastic. It was a 1-hour show, which I really liked. And Chris Jericho was just awesome last Wednesday. He, believe it or not, Chris Jericho is one of my favorite wrestlers ever. Ric Flair is my favorite wrestler ever. And then there's like a 6-way tie for second place. And Jericho's in it along with guys like Terry Funk and Jerry Lawler. That's how much I love Chris Jericho.
Wow. It goes back to WCW days. Like, he just
– yeah.
He was Smoky Mountain for me. He was so much fun. Like, his debut was probably one of my favorite debuts of all time because of the back and forth with The Rock. Like, that was just like, it couldn't have been done any better.
That was a memorable night. And yeah, like I said, I go back to Smoky Mountain with Chris Jericho. All right, we promised a mailbag show, and y'all are going to get one. I am going to hand the hosting duties over to my friend Sean Goodwin. Sean, go right ahead.
All right, we'll start with the mailbag and start off with Greg Clark. Now, I'm going to have to defer to John on this one, and maybe Keith, because I've never heard of this one before. I heard that Greg said that he heard that Bret Hart and Randy Savage were in talks with WCW in 1989. How close were they to actually going?
Keith, John? Have you heard anything about this?
I haven't heard anything about this, but that would have definitely made the landscape of WCW very interesting. That would have been a very interesting power shift.
Okay, here's what I heard back in 1989, that Randy Savage's contract was coming up with WWF. I'll go with Savage first. His contract was going to be expiring, and WCW did make a play for Randy Savage, and supposedly whatever they offered him was nothing short of embarrassing. You know, there was no way he was going to leave, you know, WWF to make less money in WCW. And I remember being blown away by the story, because obviously, if you have a chance to get a guy like Randy Savage, you have to blow him away the way they blew Kevin Nash away 5 years later. I think it was 6 years later, whatever, when they offered him a $750,000 contract per year. That's $15,000 a week with a reduced schedule. And Bischoff looked at it, and you know, Bischoff's a smart guy. He looked at it as, hey, if I'm going to get this Monday Nitro show going, I need to start getting guys from the WWF. In 1989, I had a talk with someone in WCW who's really smart, knows the business, and he was saying, look, the problem isn't that we don't have talent. We have Ric Flair, we have Sting, we have Luger, we have the Steiners, etc. And he's like, we don't need Randy Savage. And I didn't disagree with him out loud, but I used to go on a radio show right around WrestleMania, a local one, and we would talk wrestling for an hour or two. the questions, and this is right around this time frame, started in 87 and ended in 92. Every other call would be like, when's Ric Flair coming to the WWF? When are the Road Warriors coming to the WWF? When's Sting coming to the WWF? No one ever asked me, when's Hulk Hogan going to WCW? When's Randy Savage going to WCW? So I think they had to turn around that perspective to make fans think that, hey, WCW is a real thing. I know they talked to Randy Savage, Bret Hart. I heard the same thing that – right around this time, 89, 90, that they kicked the tires on Bret Hart to see if he wanted to come in and get a major singles push. And I'm not sure what the story is, why he didn't come. Probably the same thing as Savage. They didn't offer him enough money.
I go one step further and say that the reason you're hearing about this is because they both used it as leverage. Because in 1989, there's no way in your right mind. You're making, as John said, that leap that way. Six, seven years later, okay, now you're going to go to WCW. Not back then. I mean, WWF was kind of they were still doing very well. And Randy was getting a push. I'm guessing the contract was up and they both wanted to use a little, especially Bret is not going to leave. Not after, because Stu was one of the few guys that, Vince kind of took care of.
And I feel like with Bret Hart too, it feels like if, because he pretty much got his push after that. Like, they had to make a decision on whether or not they knew they had a future with him, and they did. So, it was probably leverage for him with what he got paid and such like that as well. So, I definitely agree with you on that.
Exactly. I mean, Bret was kind of stuck in a tag team, and the guys in the tag teams didn't make the big money. And what do you know, 1989, Bret starts getting his singles push. But, Sean, here's another perspective, okay? The way WWF contracts work, you were guaranteed $50 every 3 weeks for doing TV tapings every 3 weeks. The rest of it was based on your merchandise and based on attendance. If WCW had offered Randy Savage a big guaranteed contract that was worth more than what he was making in the WWF, I mean, I see no reason why he wouldn't take the money.
I guess, but it's just I don't know. Who made that leap, though? That's what I'm asking. Why did no one ever make that leap if this is a feasible thing? No one
because
ever
the money
went
wasn't
that
there.
Way.
The money wasn't there and the move wasn't right because the first person to technically make that real leap was Hogan. Well, no, it was Hall and Nash, and then it was Hogan.
And right, that'd be like, 6 years later, yeah.
Yeah, it was because, like, you kind of went through a period. Like, the only thing that you got to remember, before NWO, people only really turned into WCW for the first hour for the cruiserweight action. Like that was a thing that like that before like Raw got started when you had Eddie Guerrero, Malenko, Benoit, you had the Thoroughbreds on and people would watch those matches. At least like people that I knew, like the fans that were kind of like me, like we love the in-ring action. That's all we cared about, and then we would shift over because NWO got kind of corny when like it just became too big. And then it was like the thing with Sting, like I thought it was dope, but I thought if you would have scaled it down, it would have been way, way better.
I agree. And you know what? Just to clarify, the WCW did not even get Hulk Hogan from the WWF. Hogan was gone from the WWF and was doing some cable TV thing.
Thunder in Paradise.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And Eric Bischoff wined him and dined him and gave him a contract that made people say, what's going on here? This is ridiculous what he was making and the kind of creative control he had. And then he turned around and gave Kevin Nash, I think, three times what he was making in the WWF. That's going to get your attention. But what he was trying to do was establish WCW as not the minor league. And I think he succeeded.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah. As far as that goes. But I don't see them making that in like an 89. Well, yeah, I don't know. Maybe you're right. Maybe there was enough money. And I want to jump a question here because this kind of involves what we're talking about now. Owen Hart was on a tryout in WCW around 1991 with two TV tape matches. Why was it that he didn't stay longer? And what do you think would have happened if he was used the right way?
Keith, let me ask you this. Did you see Owen Hart in WCW in 1991? He came and went like before I don't even think he was on the Saturday Night Show. I think he was just on Worldwide.
Like just to not to, date you guys or whatever, but I was eight around that time. So
all right.
scattered around between Nintendo, Sega Genesis, all that kind of stuff, and, you know, bouncing around. So whatever we got market-wise being in New York. But I do always remember seeing Owen Hart, and Owen Hart was always one of those guys that was like, and I'm not saying this in a derogatory reference, but he's like a Dolph Ziggler in a sense, like the guy who's like phenomenal athlete, good technical wrestler, like really good matches. And then it was kind of like until like late, like when he started doing his heel turn, he just, because he looked like Billy Zabka from Karate Kid. So him being a bad guy made sense because he had that look. So I never got to see the WCW stuff in there, but I feel like with him, it definitely wasn't a matter of talent. It might have just been, you're up there with a lot of names. Like, there was a lot more names than, like, the Arn Andersons and those guys that have been legendary. You have the Hart name attached to it. You don't know what the culture was back then, and it was a little bit different. And with Bret Hart and things like that, with your brother and your family, it kind of makes it, and, you know, your dad's even involved with Vince. It makes it a little bit easier to be home.
Yeah, I loved that angle where Owen was shooting with Brett, because Brett came out and he said, you know, afterwards, he's like, you know, I had people coming up to me when that feud was going on, and they're like, yeah, I totally understand. My brother and I have share a table at Thanksgiving together. We hate each other that much. I was like, oh my God. 'Cause it, you know, to me that seemed unreal. But when, as soon as he said that, I'm like, oh wow. Okay. Sean, any thoughts on Owen Hart in WCW in 1991? 'Cause I have an idea what happened.
Oh, well, whatever happened was good for Owen, because by 1991, WCW was turning into reverse alchemists. They were taking gold and turning into lead. Actually, there was Paul, one of our guys, Paul, brought up a side story on this, saying that the story that he had heard about Owen in WCW is that the plan was for him to team with Pillman, and that the team was going to be called the Wings.
I had not heard that. I know someone who knew Owen, and Owen did a tryout, and they liked him, and they were going to push him. I'm not sure what they were going to do with him, and Owen just wasn't that interested. And I asked someone who knew Owen, like, what's going on here? You know, WCW seems interested. I can't tell you exactly what he told me, but the gist of it was he was happy being at home, relaxing with his girlfriend Martha, and he made enough money in Japan, Mexico, and Europe to make the whole thing work.
He probably was there long enough to get the drift that the place was nuts.
Maybe, although I do know from what I heard, they were interested in bringing him in and giving him a pretty good push. And you're right. Maybe he just knew better to stay away from this thing.
Owen seemed like a smart guy when it came to that stuff.
Yeah, and he, you know, he was a guy who, from what I've heard, liked the idea of getting on a plane, going to Japan for 3 weeks, coming home, spending a month at home, and then, you know, going to Europe for another 3 weeks.
Yeah, like Hansen.
Exactly like.
Okay, we'll go to next question. This is eclectic. What is your favorite sports entertainment show that wasn't wrestling? For example, he gives American Gladiators and Roller Derby. Keith, what do you think?
I'm definitely going to have to go with like American Gladiators, because we'd see some people get lit up. But also like some of those things look really, really, really fun. And so it was just kind of like, you know, I could do it. You would get banged up, but it always felt like it'd be fun doing it.
All right, Sean, how about you?
Roller derby. I guess it's a certain age. I caught the end of it. The old version, the San Francisco Bay Bombers and the L.A. T-Birds. Charlie O'Connell, Ralphie Valadares. And yes, it was cheesy, but it was a guilty pleasure and it was fun. And it kind of had that live feel the way they did the broadcast, almost like the WCW Nitro except bad. And, you know, just kind of that chaotic feel. It was goofy fun.
You know what? My favorite sports entertainment show, I remember back when these things were hot, people would ask me, oh, you're a big wrestling guy. You must love these things. I don't think I watched 10 seconds of American Gladiators. I never got into roller derby. I was going to say I liked wrestling, so I liked boxing too until Marvin Hagler retired. But that's not sports entertainment, so I just wasn't into it.
Yeah, American Gladiators was just one of those things like, for me, if it was on TV, I knew by then I was going to be going outside, because it probably usually Saturday mornings we had to clean up the house. All right. Like we'd be done by like 11, and that's when it kind of came on and be like, all right, cool. Now get started with the day. Like I did all my chores. I'm good to go. So it was kind of more like that. Like after a while, it just got more and more ridiculous. And then I think one of the guys ended up being in Mortal Kombat. We were just like, yeah, I'm done with all this.
Okay. Go on to our next question here. I can comment about the scenario. I can't comment about the specific, but the question is this. How do you think the upcoming Tyson Fury, Braun Strowman, if I pronounce that wrong, I apologize, will stack up against other boxer wrestling matches in the past?
Any thoughts, Keith?
Honestly, I don't. Like, I liked the interaction that they had. And to be honest, like, I kind of wished, like, I like that it's, like, because they're eye to eye. Like, I knew they both were big, but, like, when they actually stood eye to eye, it does kind of look like a little bit of fun. Like, you kind of do get a little excited about what can go down. I definitely think it's going to be better than Mayweather Big Show. And definitely anything. It's probably going to be the best one to date because both these guys are actually really good athletes. Like, Braun Strowman is a genetic freak.
Yeah. Sean, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Keith.
And I'm more excited about that than I am about Brock Kane just because I don't like how Brock won the title. And I don't like that, you know, this feud with somebody who Cain Velasquez has been wrestling, but people aren't familiar with him. And they're not going to let him wrestle like he was in Mexico because he was doing a lot more high flying stuff. So it's going to be like a handicap Cain Velasquez versus Brock Lesnar. And it's like, if you're going to let him wrestle the way he's been wrestling, it'd be completely different. And that's the thing with Braun Strowman. Are you going to let Braun Strowman kind of do some stuff? And it's up to Tyson Fury on what he's going to let happen. But I think just for the scale from size and from who they have, I think it's going to be the best one that they've done.
Interesting, because I liked Big Show versus Mayweather. I think that's going to be – I actually liked Bigelow against Taylor too. Sean, any thoughts on the on Tyson Fury versus Strowman, or are you just – that's not your kind of wrestling?
Well, my problem with it is this. The whole reason they started doing the boxing wrestling thing was basically to put over wrestling. So if you're a wrestling promoter, so say this is the 40s, 50s, the baddest guy on the planet is the heavyweight champion. That's what every part, you know, sports fan knows. So to put over your wrestlers, what you do is you bring the boxer in, and a wrestler's going to win anyway, just on technique. Just it's a different sport. It's like having a hockey player come in and try out for the Red Sox and see how it works. It's an entirely different muscle set you're using. You're using muscles wrestling. So it doesn't make sense. It's only to put, you know, the whole point of the match is to put somebody over. To actually have it as a real competitive match is pointless.
All right. One thing I want to say, every time I see this, I go back to, and God, it was 25 years ago, more than that, when the WWF signed Lawrence Taylor, who was just a huge name in football. I mean, Lawrence Taylor might have been the best player in the entire – either side of the ball, best player of the 80s. And he's retired now. He does the WWF thing. And he's on ESPN, and they're like, you know, oh, Lawrence, you know, has it – what are you going to do here against Bam Bam Bigelow? And he's just playing along, like, you know. If they were asking me that question, I would have had Lawrence Taylor go out there and say, look, I don't know about anything – about WWF scripts. I don't know about anything about what these guys think they're going to tell me what I'm going to do. What I know is I'm going to go out there and I'm going to beat the crap out of this Bam Bam Bigelow guy. I would have made it look like Lawrence Taylor had lost his mind and wasn't going to play by the rules and was going to shoot on Bam Bam Bigelow. But no.
Well, you have to do that because it makes no sense any other way.
They didn't do it the other way. They were just like, hey, right. How do you feel about getting into the scripted sport? And he's like, well, you know, it's all fun and whatevs.
Were they playing up off of the Bo Jackson hobby thing?
No, that never came up as far as I know. That both the
Bo I'm Jackson just saying as far as like.
I will say the results of Bam Bam and Lawrence Taylor though, like it was a moment. Like it definitely was like one of those moments that it was like Lawrence Taylor's at WrestleMania. Like it's kind of crazy, but it was executed very very well amongst the two of them.
I agree. With that.
Let me ask you, John, how much do you think that hurt Bigelow?
Didn't hurt him at all. Not a bit. It elevated him. I think it elevated him.
I think he might have been surprised by the strength, though. I think he might have been like, okay. Like, you know, there's a difference, like, where you can take a hit, but you can also kind of feel someone else's strength and being like, okay, like, I'm acknowledging you. Like, yeah, like, you ain't weak. I'll say that much. You know, it's kind of one of those things. Like, I'm 6'6", 300 plus pounds. So, like, if I bump into another guy, it's kind of like, especially a guy closer to my size, like, we kind of have a moment where we're like, yo, like, that was an accident. You good? Because it's like two bulls in a china shop. But, like, you can physically feel somebody's weight just by a nudge and be like, hey, man, like, yo, like, hey, like, I don't just get knocked out of my own way just by nothing. So it's kind of like, you know, I think it's like, you know, it didn't hurt, but he definitely was like, I don't want to take a hit when I don't want to take one of these hits on the field.
Yeah.
When full speed at me, like,
dang, I'm always the smallest guy in the room. But anyway, all right. What question you got for yours next, Mr. Goodwin?
Next, we have Sergeant Slaughter stays in the WWF in 1985. How does his run play out?
Keith, do you have an opinion on this?
Nah, unfortunately, I was young enough to where, like, G.I. Joe was how I really got introduced to Sergeant Slaughter. You know what I'm saying? Like, he was out there, and, like, I remember when he, like, joined with the Iron Sheik, and I remember all that. And that was just a big thing because Desert Storm was, like, right on the horizon and all that, and they really played on that. But as far as, like, how his career and all that, I kind of missed that boat.
No, that makes sense. How about you, Sean?
I think as a face, he probably would have played out. You can almost feel him starting to get played out a little bit, like you were a snooker. I think a heel turn would have done him wonders in 1985. But let me, this is a question you may know, John. Would, say he stayed with the WWF and win heel and got a run against Hogan, would that have made up for the money he would have lost by the G.I. Joe deal?
I can't say because I don't know what he got out of the G.I. Joe deal. It wasn't enough to get
there
him to not. That's true.
There was a cartoon movie.
Yeah, I mean, he like I said, I don't know, but I mean, he was still wrestling independence. He was still working for the AWA. I mean, granted, I'm sure he wasn't getting normal AWA wages. But let's say none of that existed. Let's say Sergeant Slaughter just stays with the WWF. I mean, I was a fan in 84. The Sergeant Slaughter versus Iron Sheik was one of the hottest feuds ever. I mean, it was almost like we were waiting for Sergeant Slaughter to turn and show this guy a lesson. Then as that feud kind of came and went, then Nikolai Volkoff comes in, summer of 84. I remember, like, not only me, but my wrestling fans were kind of going – kind of like, oh, okay, gee, I wonder what Nikolai Volkoff's going to be doing here. And he did exactly what we thought he was going to do. And it was almost like, you know, is this going to be the ongoing thing where every 4, 5, 6 months they bring in a new foreign menace for Sergeant Slaughter to feud with, because it was already feeling kind of old. So I think Slaughter would have just done what just about every other babyface wound up doing, is just, you know, getting, you know, staler and staler and lower on the card until he's finally gone. And I don't think they would have turned him heel at this point in 1984, 1985, maybe even further down the road. I don't think they would have turned him heel because of his image as the all-American hero.
Well, they didn't mind doing that a few years later. So a couple of questions in a row. Who would have had a better run as NWA champion, David Von Erich or Magnum T.A.?
Keith, what do you think?
From what I've heard about the Von Erichs, like, of course, a legendary fan, but when I hear people talk about Magnum T.A., they talk with, like, a reverence, and I feel like he might have had a more interesting and longer run just because of the reputation that I've heard about from older fans.
Any thoughts from you?
Well, it depends on when you're talking about, because if you're talking about 1982, I would say David, because David was probably a little more dynamic. I don't know if Magnum could be a heel. I do know David could be an effective heel because he was in Florida with Dory. I know we could draw in different territories. I think for the earlier type champion, like 81, 82, he would have been a better choice. If you're looking more at 85, the national expansion, where you need kind of that, it's more babyface centric. Kind of, then you're probably looking more at Magnum, who, you know, can't, you know, like Hogan, has limitations elsewhere, but is a great babyface.
Yeah, I mean, I've said this on the show before. I mean, I thought the world of Von Erich as far as him having potential. I mean, here's a guy, you know, we forget he died when he was only 24 years old. He was a legit 6'7". He was thin, but I think he would have filled out just like, you know, every other 24-year-old skinny tall guy fills out eventually. I think he would have had a huge future, and I'm going with David. I think Magnum, by, you know, people don't like me saying this, but I'll say it. I think by the time Magnum had his automobile accident, his popularity had not only peaked but was beginning to decline. I think that baby faces like that have a shelf life. Especially Magnum. I think the girls who liked him either had already gotten tired of or were about to become tired of seeing him, you know, on TV screaming at the camera every week with his forehead more scarred up this week than the last week, and at the arena seeing him covered in his own blood. I think, you know, I could be wrong about that. Maybe Magnum had a big comeback in him. He was supposed to have a big feud with Ric Flair at the beginning of 1987. But to answer this question, David Von Erich all the way.
And we will now go to the mask wrestlers here. This was – I had trouble with this. Who had a better career as a mask wrestler, the Assassin, Jody Hamilton, or the mask superstar, Bill Eady? Now, keep in mind, this is as a masked wrestler only, so we're not counting Bill Eady in his other incarnations.
All right. Yeah, Keith, is this before your time, or do you have an opinion?
I've never heard of either one of these gentlemen, so I'd have to do my research. As far as me growing up, if I had to say like my favorite masked wrestlers, it would either have to be Tiger Mask, it would have to be Great Muta or Jushin Thunder Liger, like those guys, and maybe Ultimo Dragon. Like those guys were the guys like that I really grew up with that I got to see as masked wrestlers. But yeah, I do have to head out. I have to get ready for work.
All right, Keith. Well, thank you for taking the time. And yeah, it was great talking to you.
I appreciate you guys having it on me. Thank you. I appreciate being on the show.
All right. You're welcome. We'll have you on again anytime. Take care.
All right. Definitely. Have a good one, guys.
Just you and I, Sean.
I think we can take it home.
We'll try.
Go ahead, John.
No, I was going to say, what's your opinion? Assassin or superstar?
The Assassin on longevity.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I would say for a shorter period of time, I'm a huge mass superstar Mark. I think he was fantastic in the late 70s, but he was only that character from 76 to like 84, 85. Assassin Jody Hamilton was doing that for 30 years?
Close to it.
So, yeah, he excelled most of the time doing it.
I mean, really tough question that I actually spent a great deal of time thinking about. I mean, you can go – I have to go with the Assassin for longevity, just barely over the mass superstar. I mean, Assassin was around – he was still around being the Assassin like 1987. Granted, it was, you know, smaller territories, but they had – what was it? I'm trying to remember the name. I think it was Southern Championship Wrestling out of Georgia. He was the booker, and yeah, he was still wrestling. But mass superstar, I mean, man, you know, here's a guy who held the Georgia State title. He held the Mid-Atlantic title, NWA tag team titles. He main evented Madison Square Garden twice against Backlund. And yeah, he was around as mass superstar as late as early 1986. So if you had to go career highlights, I think it would be superstar. But overall, my pick with just a slight edge is Jody Hamilton's the Mass Assassin.
We have a question that has your name written all over it, sir. Tim would like you to explain, how did the WWF decide which heel was paired with which manager? Blassie had the Foreign Menaces, but also had Hogan, Adonis, Ventura, who seemed like the typical wizard guys. So how was it decided?
I mean, obviously, either Vince Sr. or after he took over, Vince Jr. decided this one. You know, I'm kind of guessing. I mean, my friends and I had, you know, had the grid. Okay, it was Fred Blassie got all of the Foreign Menaces, Captain Lou Albano got all of the tag teams and the Geeks, and Grand Wizard got the guys who were actually good. Hogan fits into the actually good, and Adonis and Ventura actually seem definitely more like Grand Wizard guys. I think exceptions were made when a wrestler – basically when one of the managers had something else going on. And wow, by the way, we're almost like 40 years from the day Hulk Hogan started with the WWF. But I think – I'm just guessing here. But I think when Hogan came in, Pat Patterson was still with the Grand Wizard, and they had to know that Ken Patera was coming back in like another 6 weeks. So they probably said, okay, Wizard's got Patera, he's got Patterson, let's give this Hogan guy to someone else, and Albano would not have made a lot of sense. Adonis and Ventura, I mean, this was a time Grand Wizard was managing Greg Valentine and Don Morocco. So I think once again, the natural pairing of Grand Wizard with one of these guys doesn't make sense. And they just put in Fred Blassie instead. But a really good question.
Another subcategory to put them in is that also Blassie handled what you would call the attractions. Yeah, which would be considered Hogan, like your, you know, your 300-pound, whatever, the attraction coming in, or, you know, which most foreign menaces would go into this category. But a guy who comes in for a quick, you know, few weeks or something like that, and, you know, comes in and pops the house or something like that, those guys usually would go to Blassie too. When you went to the Wizard, that usually meant you were getting a title shot. You were getting three set with MSG. Not only were you good, you were getting a title shot. So that was like the definitive. It wasn't just you were good. You were, you know, you were getting the three set. And Albano, again, was always basically tag teams, and basically tag teams who could not talk at all.
Yes. Either they just couldn't talk or their gimmick. But it was kind of fun. Like, you know, sometimes 75-80% of the time, if you knew a guy was coming to the WWF, a heel, you knew which manager he would get. But then the curveballs were fun sometimes. Like, Ken Patera was not a Lou Albano guy, but that's who he was with the first run. George the Animal Steel was not a Fred Blassie guy, but that's who he was with in 83 and 85. So I think they had a pattern, but when they broke from it, it was enjoyable.
Was there ever a concern from a wrestler? Like, okay, let's take my man Don Morocco. Mm-hmm. If you start off with Wizard and end up with Captain Lou, is there like a concern that you're going the wrong way on the totem pole?
Probably not. I do know this, like Jesse Ventura, and I heard this like a long time ago, was really unhappy when he came to the WWF at fall 81 that they gave him Fred Blassie. And he's like, no, I am a really good talker. Why are you giving me a manager? And it's like, Jesse, because that's just how things are done around here. If you go out there without a manager, they're not going to take you seriously as a heel.
Yeah, you're right. And that was just the way the fans were educated. Mm-hmm. Okay, second I saw this question, I thought of you. Because you gave a great explanation about this a few months ago. What this question is about to say is revisionist history, and you straighten everyone out. The question is this. Let's say Fritz decides not to create Lance Von Erich, but he still wants a third guy to team with Kevin and Kerry. Who does he get or elevate for the spot? Now, first things first, the idea that Lance did not work in that spot is a fallacy, correct?
A complete fallacy. He was over like crazy.
When did he not become over?
He was over until the day he walked out.
Right, until the day he walked out, and then he tried to run opposition on him, and then Fritz ratted him out.
Right, and which was Fritz – it wasn't shooting himself in the foot. It was shooting himself in the chest, but anyway.
Right, but I mean so that's when the whole idea of Lance, oh, what a mistake. It wasn't a mistake. It was only a mistake afterwards, but nonetheless, we'll take the question anyway. So who do you elevate for that spot?
Okay. What are the qualifications to be Lance Von Erich? You want someone who is muscular and good-looking. You want someone who – basically, the wrestling fans are unfamiliar with. For example, Ricky Vaughn wrestled in Portland, I want to say 7 or 8 months before they brought him to Texas and made him Lance Von Erich. About a year and a half after Michael Hayes somehow – 2.5 years after Michael Hayes introduces the character by bringing him in as a possibility as a surprise tag team partner. If I had to pick one guy who had already been to wrestling school, had been trained, a good-looking guy, but hasn't been around the circuit, hasn't been in the magazines. The number one guy I can think of is a gentleman named Steve Borden. He was part of that Pro Wrestling USA thing that they were doing in Memphis, and then they turned him. And fall 85 is when they introduced Lance at the Cotton Bowl show. He's the best guy I can come up with who fits the parameters.
Yeah, you just got the answer. I said I wouldn't have done the I'm going to talk out the other side of my mouth right now because I'm going to say I wouldn't have got a brother. I would have got some family friend or something, like a Brody kind of thing, you know, where Brody was the great family friend and that was the only place he was ever a baby face. I'm sure there were other places, but I mean, he was always kind of a big baby face there. Same with Chris Adams, that kind of thing. Some guy out of the blue and they knew each other from wherever. I would do something like that because the family thing, especially the way it was in Dallas, is risky. Because all you need to do is find out that have that little thing come apart. You saw even with Lance, he wasn't even with them anymore, and it backlashed on him.
Yeah, I mean that was Fritz's own fault. I mean, I think enough people knew because Ricky Vaughn was a big football star in the Dallas area. I think people just accepted it for what it was. I think you wanted to have someone use the name Von Erich. Here's where Lance was really valuable in a lot of ways. Someone who was with the promotion told me this, that Kerry and Kevin were tired of making public appearances. They were tired of the autograph signings. And Lance was happy to step in and do them. And so now you've got a Von Erich who is at your car dealership, who makes an appearance on the radio station, et cetera. Having Chris Adams, friend of the family, it just doesn't do that.
I'm just talking for the sake of talking to make your devil's advocate, trying to find something. You have the right answer.
Fair enough.
Steve Borden's the guy. I mean, and now that you said that with the reason they needed him, now he's completely the perfect guy. That has Steve Borden written all over it, going out and kissing babies and shaking hands and all that stuff.
You know what? I had a couple of other – Steve Borden is like the only real guy I could come up with. There were a couple of guys that that were in Mid-South for, a cup of coffee in early 85, and they did something to piss Watts off, and Watts was still talking about him on TV after he canned him. A tag team, Steve Constance and Tim Ashley, they couldn't do anything. They couldn't talk. They couldn't work, but they got out of wrestling school, and they were good-looking guys. So those are my number two and number three. And don't get me wrong. Lance Von Erich stunk in the ring, and he was one of the worst interviews I've ever seen, but he that didn't matter to the people who attended the World Class shows. They loved him.
Oh, no, it didn't. None of the Von Erichs, for the most part, could wrestle. I mean, you know, David was okay. I guess Kevin was okay. You had to catch Kerry on the right day. That wasn't – that. Like great wrestling wasn't necessarily taught there. That wasn't part of the education. It was more entertainment, much like WWF is, as opposed to like Georgia and, you know, Mid-Atlantic and Florida particularly, where it was kind of emphasized.
Kevin was really, really good early in his career.
Fair enough.
Before the injuries caught up to him and he started losing interest. Kerry, I always thought was – I mean, he was better than – you're right. You had to catch Kerry on the right night. But I always thought Kerry was way better than average. I don't think Kerry was bad at all until he had the motorcycle accident. And after that, he was still passable.
I'll be fair on this. I may be referring him from the end when he got – when it wasn't very good at all. So you may have a point here to get out in front of that one. So next up we have – how and against who would you have booked the Road Warriors at Starrcade 85?
I'll tell you what. I'd like to hear your answer first.
See, my problem is all the really good matches would not do what you need to do, which is get them over. So I was going through teams. If you want a good match, I'm going with the Andersons. But again, you're not going to get a clean job on the Andersons. For a good draw, the Russians. Same problem because you're pushing them too. So you need someone who you're kind of pushing, but you can have take a loss. I'll say the Long Riders.
Okay, that's actually a way better answer than mine. And you're right, they're still there. And yeah, Ron Bass had already split with J.J. Dillon, but you can hold that off if you know the Road Warriors are coming in. Now, here's the thing. I have two answers for this. Are you just bringing them in as a special attraction? If you are, try to get the Freebirds. Try to get Hayes and Gordy, even though I know there's some political strife between the Freebirds and JCP at this point. If you don't want to do that, why not have Jimmy Garvin and Steve Regal defend the AWA titles against tag team titles against the Road Warriors as a special attraction for Starrcade? But if you know they're coming in and they started with JCP January 1986, so like 5-6 weeks later, why not have bring them in as, okay, the Road Warriors make their NWA debut tonight at Starrcade. The tag team I came up with was the Zambui Express. Bring them in. They're big, imposing guys. They can do a, you know, 2-3 minute job to the Road Warriors. But I actually like the one you came up with better. That, you know, hold off Ron Bass's turn and do Ron Bass and Black Bart. Good one, Sean.
And I am thrilled that you brought up Steve Constance and Tim Ashley, because now I have a big market tease.
Oh.
Okay. And next up, here's another one right in your wheelhouse. What did you think of Captain Lou's face turn?
I'll tell you what. I will never forget. I was watching TNT, I would say towards the middle or end of 1984. It was right around Christmas. And Captain Lou Albano is reading a Christmas carol to a couple of small children. And he gets done reading it. He reads it, you know, straight babyface fashion, and the kids turn around and they've got like Captain Lou Albano mustaches and goatees. They turn around, smile, and they we look like Captain Lou Albano. And I thought I was gonna drop on the floor dead of a heart attack. I'm like, oh my God, they're turning Lou Albano. This is impossible, I think to myself. I'm reading this wrong, I think to myself. And within a week or two, they did the big angle where Cyndi Lauper, you know, was in the ring giving him an award for multiple sclerosis, and Roddy Piper breaks it over his head. It was a shocker, but I thought it was an effective shocker. I think Albano, at this point in his career, I think he's a relatable babyface manager, and those never work. And this didn't work long term anyway, but he definitely helped get the British Bulldogs over. I don't think they would have been anywhere near what they were with Albano. It only lasted a year and a half before Vince McMahon got tired of Albano and finally fired him for real for good. They had his retirement ceremony on WWE Superstars. But yeah, that was the last time they used him in a long time. Any thoughts from you, Sean?
Yeah, the reason it was on TV was that it made sure it was official.
Yes. No backing out of this one.
Lou was one of those guys who, like Lawler in Memphis, who was just so over in New York, it really didn't matter. He was going to be over no matter what you wanted to put him as. And you're right. It did work for a short period of time. And they got over the Bulldogs. But more importantly, he got over Cyndi Lauper.
Yes,
he provided them cred with the old school WWF fans who love Lou. They're like, okay, because as you're saying, they hate Lou, love Lou, but it's the same emotion. Love and hate, there's not that much of a difference. Okay, the difference between love and hate is indifference. Not, you know, so I mean, the fans always love Lou. They always would love Lou in New York, but I mean, he's a more fun heel. But you're right. He kind of needed him here for this spot. It was toward the end of his career. So, hey, let him get some applause. But without question, he's a better heel all day.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, it was just time, especially in 1984. I mean, they're bringing in all of these managers. They're bringing in Bobby Heenan, Jimmy Hart, et cetera. Fred Blassie was needed to retire. Grand Wizard was gone. So Albano was kind of getting lost in the shuffle in his role as a heel. And I think that's what made the babyface turn almost necessary, you know. And he came across as a babyface, kind of that drunk uncle you can relate to, you know. I mean, okay, he's kind of a mess, but he's a fun guy overall.
He was the same guy. He was the exact same guy, except he was with good people as opposed to with bad people.
Yeah,
and he wasn't
really.
Being, you know, he wasn't doing his ridiculous cheating where he's like reaching in to, you know, waving the blade or whatever, or the knuckles around and, you know, putting them back in his pants or whatever like that, that whole deal. So, I mean, it's the same. He's basically, it's like Lawler. When Lawler turns like babyface or heel, it's the same guy. It's just a little tweak here and there, and he's against different people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like a Ted DiBiase thing where it's like an overhaul. So, but yeah, you're right. It's like, it was kind of like a nice swan song for Lou, I guess.
I mean, I don't think they were planning for it to be a swan song either. I think they just felt like they needed to turn the guy. And I think had Lou behaved, I think he would have been around almost as long as he would have wanted to. But I mean, I think it was one of those things that Albano came in, or, you know, when Vince Jr. came in, Albano was established and, hey, this is just the owner's son. Hey, Jr., what are you doing? And now Vince is the boss and he wants Albano to, you know, he wants to show everyone, like, he can't have a guy like Lou Albano treat him like shit in front of everybody.
No.
Expecting respect in return.
I think it was he may not have admitted it, but I think it was this one song. He wanted him out. I mean,
yeah, you may be right.
You get, there's only so much pain in the ass you need in your life, you know. And this is, you know, this isn't Lou from from 74. And you're trying to get a little more mainstream, you know. Yeah. And you know, Lou's just a little crazy. So I think he was working him for the door.
I agree. And you know what? The hour always goes by so quickly.
Hold on, I got one more because I can't pass this one up because I found this so interesting.
What's
Piper stays and Flair goes to New York instead in 1984.
That is the first question we're going to answer next week because we have so many unanswered questions.
Cool.
That we are going to go down the list and continue next week as opposed to collecting new ones. So, yeah, we've got two more of these shows for the inquiries of October. Going on, and it certainly won't be the last time we take a do a mailbag show. Sean, thank you for all you do. Sean does so much off the air that you guys don't see, but he is a giant contributor to this show. Also, another giant contributor is our friend Luke Kippelman, our producer. I want to thank him for everything he does. And this has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. We'll see you next week. Go Vols.